What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including an alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Hello, 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 and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. We are so excited about tonight's show. It's going to be really great. We have an all-star cast. We have Marianne Williamson, the former presidential candidate and the best-selling author, The Phenomenon. Make sure you check out her work, her Transform podcasts and her Transform Substack. We also have joining us two amazing congressional candidates, Rebecca Parson and Jason Call, and we're going to talk more about who they are shortly, but they are non-corporate congressional candidates. And we are going to talk about challenging Biden from the left. We're going to talk about the state of American politics, I mean, international politics, inevitably also. We're going to talk also about why these two progressives are running as Democrats, given how critical they are of the Democratic Party. And there's, of course, a lot of debate and discussion about how redeemable the Democrats are, about whether people should be running as Democrats. So we're going to get into all of that. But before I bring in our guest, just a little bit of logistics. So welcome to the Katie Helper Show. So glad to be joined by all of you. Lovely to see you all. We're going to follow up the live stream show with a call-in show. Now, call-in is an app. So everyone get out your cell phones and download the app Call-In. It's a free app if you have an iPhone, or I think you can actually now do it on Android. But it's especially cool if you have an iPhone. You'll hear why in a second. But download the app Call-In, and then you'll see the link probably if you go to Katie Helper Show or the Katie Helper Show. Just download Call-In. You'll be able to find the show. And you'll be able to ask us questions. So you'll be able to call in and ask us questions. Also, want to thank everyone for becoming Patreon supporters. We passed the 1,000 mark, which is amazing. So we couldn't do the show without you. We're so grateful to everyone who became Patreon supporters. And if you're not a Patreon supporter, please consider becoming a Patreon supporter. For just $1 a month, you help the show happen. For $5 a month, you get exclusive premium content, extended interviews, extra interviews. So highly recommend it, if I do say so myself. Also, please subscribe. This is the way you can support the show for free. You just hit subscribe, and then the bell. Also, you can become YouTube members, and some new members are in the chat tonight. Lauren, thank you, Lauren, for becoming a new member. Felicity became a new member. Thank you so much for that. You get badges and you also get emojis, little Bodhi emojis. We'll have to show people those. Bodhi is my very cute dog. So we'll give you guys a tour of those on another show. But want to thank everyone. So I think we're just going to bring in our first guest. So excited to bring her in. You know her. You love her. The inimitable thought leader, spiritual leader, and political leader, Marianne Williamson. Hello, Marianne.
Hi, beautiful Katie. How are you?
Good. You?
Good. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining the show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Always happy to be here.
So we're going to get into two related discussions. One is that you and Crystal Ball and Brianna Joy Gray and I did a live stream for Stephen Donziger. Then you and I and Crystal and Kyle Kalinske did a live stream for Julian Assange. And next week, you and I and Crystal Ball and Brianna Joy Gray and Juliana Furlano are doing another stream, and it's going to be for non-corporate congressional candidates. And we're going to be talking more about that with our guests who are coming to join us, who are two of those very impressive non-corporate candidates. But you're also someone who's been getting a lot of chatter. You're in the zeitgeist, as you always are. But now there's been talk of a progressive challenging Biden. And you're one of the names that people have floated out there. People talked about Nina Turner, but we now know that that's impossible because she's running for Congress. Wanted to know your thoughts kind of in general about what litmus test you think there should be for someone to challenge Biden, if there is one at all. And then your thoughts on it personally.
Well, I don't think the issue is who at this moment so much as it's what. And every day I think more and more that there must be a what. There must be a challenge to the Biden agenda, whether it has to do with children who are dying in Yemen because we are selling for over $1 billion arms to Saudi Arabia, an arms sale that Trump had bragged about, but which I thought, most of us thought, based on his own words, that that Biden would have reversed, whether it has to do with the starving people in Afghanistan and the horrific exit that we made there. More and more, I'm hearing about, reading about, and interfacing with women going through the most horrific situations when our exit from Afghanistan did not prioritize helping these women to get out, who had worked as activists, as humanitarians, and in many ways, with the United States, whether it has to do with the college loan debt that Biden could end tonight if he wanted to, whether it has to do with Medicare for All that he effectively could make happen tonight if he wanted to by declaring a national medical emergency, whether it has to do with, again, a Trump-era prosecution of Julian Assange, something we thought that Biden would reverse, but that he's just hunkering down around, whether it has to do with the fact that he could deschedule marijuana from a Schedule I drug. There are just so many ways where when he said nothing will change, I think a lot of us didn't realize just how serious he was. And we're living at a time of crossroads in this country. We're in decline. We're in decline in this country. And it's not going to fix itself. If there's going to be a pattern interruption of the trajectory of decline, it's going to be because we the people make it happen. And Biden is far too aligned with the corporatist agenda that has gotten us here. The idea that an entire class of politicians who basically drove this into the ditch are now claiming that they're the only people qualified to lead us out of the ditch is absurd to me. So once again, it's not a matter of who, but it is a matter of what. And it's a matter of a very different way of looking at our economy and our politics than is now dominant in Washington. What we have now is what paved the way for Trump. What we have now is what unfortunately seems to be inviting in, at least the way things are going now, in the midterms, more of the same. And if we only offer more of the same in 2024, then I fear for our democracy.
And are there any positions that you think people need to present? Like, I know platforms only go so far, right? But they can be a kind of a bare minimum. Are there any hard lines you think that people need to make in order to even be considered challengers to Biden?
Well, there's the challengers to Biden, and then there's also the issue of the midterms and the non-corporate backed candidates that we've supported, which of course has to do with the Medicare for All, cancellation of college loan debt, Green New Deal, free college, and so forth. But I think for a presidential candidate, a presidential primary, now we don't know if Biden's going to run again, of
That's
course.
The other thing, right?
So this person might be primarying Biden. They just might be primarying the whole cabal of, you know, Ken and Barbie doll politicians who unfortunately seem to be the core of the Democratic Party these days. Very different than the traditional values of the Democratic Party that I grew up with. I grew up with a Democratic Party that was indisputably the channel for the deepest yearning of Americans who sought a just society, economically just society, socially just society, criminally just society, in which, although we had never been the full embodiment of our ideals of a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, could at least be seen to be making a damn good effort at it. And of course, that can only happen through a political channel that stands indisputably and unequivocally for the working people of the United States. So whoever is primarying Biden or a Biden-esque agenda, you know, it's not even a person anymore. There's Trump, and then there's a Trump-esque agenda. There's Biden and a Biden-esque agenda. And we need a serious pattern interruption back to a party that puts the health and the safety and the well-being of the American people and people of the world, for that matter, and the planet on which we live before the goal of short-term profit maximization for the huge corporate entities, whether it has to do with insurance companies or big pharmaceutical companies or big oil or big chemical companies, big agricultural companies, military-industrial complex. As long as that network, that matrix of corporate forces, which happens to be the corporate behemoth that has a chokehold on Congress. I mean, Congress is basically a handmaiden. It's a system of legalized bribery that does the bidding of these corporate forces. This is not only hollowed out our middle class, it's now hollowing out our democracy itself. So, yes, in order for the Democratic Party to have any chance of being what the Democratic Party even claims to be, and in order for our democracy to have a chance, we have to make a radical break from the last 40 years.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, that's the Democrats at least used to claim. And to some extent, you know, we FDR obviously was a significant social Democrat and really changed society in many ways. Then you had Johnson and Kennedy, who, you know, they also, Johnson was responsible for the Vietnam War. So we're not whitewashing history either. But there certainly were Democrats who did things that now would not be thought of. And they're, it's nice that people, I mean, they'd be thought of by we the people, but they wouldn't be considered politically viable, even though they are. But I think that the Dems have been selling out for so long, they don't even pander. They don't even know how to pretend to be the thing that they used to pretend to be and sometimes were.
Yeah, of course, the tragedy of Johnson is the incredible distinction. On one hand, a genuine war criminal with the Vietnam War, and on the other hand, the most enlightened domestic president since FDR. I mean, can you imagine a president today declaring war on poverty? So absolutely, you know, we're at a point now where the most scandalous, corrupt things, you know, Republicans just say, yeah, what of it? And Democrats themselves don't bother apologizing too much anymore. It's just kind of normalized. We have corruption is normalized in the U.S. government today. You know, this whole thing started with the Republicans, but no Democratic president has stopped it. You know, you can trace to 1980s, you can trace to trickle-down economics, you can trace to, you know, this whole idea of stockholder capitalism, fiduciary responsibility of the corporation only being to the financial gain of the stockholders, even at the expense of other stakeholders, such as the workers, the community, the environment. Yes, that started with Reagan, but no Democratic president has really stopped it. So at this point, neither party can be self-congratulatory about any of this. Both of them have driven the car that got us to where we are.
Right. And Bill Clinton really helped solidify so many of the attacks on the working class that Reagan put into place.
Well, with the Democratic, what was it, the Democratic Leadership Council, with Clinton, they inaugurated this idea that we could have it both ways.
Right.
So the Democrats, even now, try to ameliorate the pain on the periphery. You know, Clinton would say, I feel your pain. So the Democrats, you know, it's like the Republicans are ignoring people's pains and almost congratulating themselves for it. The Democrats are trying to ameliorate the pain on the suffering. You know, here's $1,200. Good luck to you. Here's the child tax credit, but only for a while. It's an amelioration of the pain on those periphery, but it's a refusal to really challenge the underlying corporate forces that make all that suffering inevitable.
Yeah. And the betrayal, of course, by the Democrats is in some ways that much more stinging than the Republicans, who never really, I don't think, claimed to be the party of the working class. I mean, they tried to trick people into thinking that trickle-down would help them, but they didn't historically.
Yeah, well, it's a mindfuck. You know, if your father beat you up and your mother stood out in the hall wringing her hands, just so upset that daddy's beating you, and when your beating is finished, mommy's going to give you cookies and hot chocolate, But she's not going to call the police, and she's not even going to leave him. When you grow up and go into therapy 20 years later, you're more angry at mommy than at daddy.
Oh, yeah. The enabler?
Mm-hmm.
Who you thought was going to protect you at some point.
Well, also, you know, I'm old enough to have an institutional memory. Some of us remember a time when the Democrats were, not that we were, you know, like you were talking about not whitewashing Johnson. I'm not whitewashing the Democratic Party. But when I grew up, there was a sense, even when I was a young woman, it was the party that was trying. And also, I grew up at a time where the coattails of FDR were very real. This is who your parents talked about at dinner. The young people today don't even have a memory. They have no experience of a time when they knew that the Democratic Party was really on their side. And some of them have a memory of a time when they really thought Barack Obama was going to be. We all did. I certainly did. And I remember with Obama, because in 2008, I totally bought into it. And I remember really getting the kind of bait and switch that he represented. And I remember when I first started talking about it, people were angry at me. And then I remember Matt Taibbi. This is when I first got to know Matt, you know, his work. I didn't know him personally, but when he said, no, it's true. And I could say, see, this guy said it in Rolling Stone or whatever it was, that this is not what we were told was going to happen. You feel like you've been bamboozled when that happens. You've been tricked. And we were.
And what are the things that you feel like you learned the most through running that you didn't see before?
First of all, I didn't know how vicious the system was. I didn't know how brutal the DNC would be if they wanted you off stage, the lengths they would go. That's number one. And number two, I don't think even though it's, as I've said this so many times, the system is more corrupt than I even knew. And people are even more wonderful, more intelligent, more decent than I knew. It was so moving, not just impressive, but moving to be around the voters in the primary states. They were very aware of how important their role was, very up on the issues. They would kick the tires, man. You go in and talk to them. What about this? What about that? And I have seen, not only based on that experience, but my entire career, we are a decent people. I'm not saying we're better than people in other countries, but we're decent, good people. I don't think Americans are happy about what's going on. The problem is not the consciousness of the American people. If you look at issue after issue, a majority of Americans want Medicare for all. A majority of Americans want to cancel the college loan debt. A majority of Americans want free college. A majority of Americans want a more righteous foreign policy. A majority of Americans want to feel we're at least trying to be a good country. The problem is not the American people. The problem is a political system that consistently and systematically obstructs the will of the American people. And right now, that includes our president. He is not serving the will of the people. He is not serving the goal of really helping tens of millions of Americans, whether it has to do with 500,000 Americans are homeless, 2 million kids every year who are experiencing homeless, 18 million Americans who can't even afford to get the prescription drugs that their doctors are prescribing for them, whether it has to do with these young people who are so shackled by these college loan debt. It's like we act like there's this bubble, which there is a bubble. And, you know, Washington, D.C., I live here now. They say all the time, you know, it's a bubble. It's not a bubble. Energetically, it's worse than that. It's like a walled city. These people are talking about an America that is really just the America of the people who are voting for them or the people who are donating to them. Because there are so many tens of millions of people out there, they don't even bother anymore. They're so crushed. And this is not the America when I was growing up. Once again, not whitewashing, but there was hope in the air that wasn't just bullshit. It wasn't just a slogan. It was a sense that we could change things. It's going to be harder now. When I heard, you know, Katie, did you see the video of Biden yesterday talking about young people?
No, what did he say?
I couldn't believe he said it. He said, oh, I hear young people say that they have it so hard. You know what I say to that? Oh, give me a break.
Is this new or is this old?
I think so. I responded to it on Twitter.
He famously said at some event, young people, they complain about how hard it is. Give me a break. I have no empathy. You know what? Because when we were out there, we...
Yes, that. Was that old or young? Yeah. I just saw it yesterday.
It's a few years old, but it's unbelievable to me that that hasn't been picked up more.
I can tell you, I was there. Yes, there were real problems, but the system wasn't so locked up. The system wasn't so locked up. There wasn't the level, there was the level of pain that people feel now. But there wasn't the level of despair that there's nothing we can do to fix it. And the people are going to have to step in now, Katie. I don't think the issue is who. I think the issue is each and every one of us in our own way.
Yeah, that was disgusting. He literally says out loud, no empathy. No empathy. I mean, the entitlement.
He says, give me a break.
Give me a break. Give me a break. I got no empathy. The entitlement is just obscene that he would say that out loud. Like, we know that you think that and you have no empathy for other people. I mean, what always kills me with Biden and empathy is that I find Hunter Biden's story pretty tragic. I feel bad for him. And I believe that people who have addiction issues and substance abuse issues should be given treatment, not jail time. But all the empathy that Hunter got because his father is Joe Biden is just the opposite of the absolute suffering and torture that other people got because they were not Joe Biden's son, but because they lived under the laws passed by Joe Biden, who bragged, of course, that every major and minor crime bill has the name of the Democrat senator from Delaware on it. So,
but you know, I don't know. I thought he had learned something.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's tough even to say this. It's like you were talking about, you're going to be talking to the congressional candidates today. Am I going to vote Democratic in 2022? You better believe I am. Well, actually, I live in Washington, D.C., so we actually don't get to vote. But, you know, supporting non-corporate back.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, let's bring in our guest, shall we? This has been great. And so you're not saying either way what's going to happen with Marianne Williamson entering the presidential race. You're focused on the issues, not the person.
I'm doing what everybody I know is doing right now, thinking through it.
I just gave you a good slogan, though. The person, not the issues. If on the off chance you decide to, the person, not the issues.
Yeah, it's like, what do they say? There's a saying in AA, actually, something not personalities. But it is the person, actually, right now. I'm just saying, I don't know if it's me, but no, we're going to need a person who stands up and says, when people shouted at FDR because he was making all these changes and his enemies said he was a socialist and he was killing capitalism, et cetera, his response was, I welcome their hatred. It's going to take someone who has the courage to just make the changes that need to be made, not abusing power, but using the power of the presidency. That's the thing. There was so much that Biden could do with executive orders. Like, everybody keeps talking, the mansion won't let him, cinema.
Yeah, no, there's so many things.
He could, whether it has to do with the cancellation of the college loan debt, the Medicare for all, and so much, that's what he could do if he wanted to do it.
Yeah, the Democrats, they pretend that their hands are tied and they never are tied as much as they claim. It's because they don't want to do the things. They pretend they can't, just that they don't want to do that. So speaking of which, let's bring in some guests who are hopefully going to be Democrats who actually do get things done. We're bringing in two non-corporate congressional candidates. Again, you can catch them on our stream, which is taking place on Wednesday the 16th. I'll put a link to that stream shortly. It'll be added into this YouTube description. Before I do that, just one really quick update, which is that, of course, you're watching The Katie Halper Show, and everyone, welcome to The Katie Halper Show if you're just joining us. If you want to write a comment, please subscribe for free. You just subscribe to the channel, hit subscribe, and then the bell. We have a nice comment for you from Ivan Escobar. I will vote D if you run. You are a big inspiration to humanity. Thank you so much, Ivan, for that and for the super chat. But let's bring on to the virtual stage. We have Jason Call, who is a husband, father, former public school math teacher, musician, and progressive activist running for Washington's 2nd District, and he has served as an elected representative to the Washington State Democratic Central Committee. Also coming onto the stage is Rebecca Parson. People who watch the show know her and love her. She's a repeat offender. Rebecca Parson is a housing organizer and Tacoma Disabilities Commissioner running for Congress in Washington's 6th District. She's the only candidate in the race supporting Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, and national rent control. So welcome. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. It's great to see you, Marianne, too.
You too, Jason.
So I wanted to have you on because you're two people who are very critical of Democrats. In fact, whenever I want to know what Democrats could be doing, because everyone pretends that they can't do it, that their hands are tied, I'll DM or I'll tag Rebecca. And I'll be like, what could a Democrat actually be doing? Because we all buy so much into the mythology that Dems just can't do anything, that their hands are tied. So I wanted to know if you could talk, each of you, about your backgrounds, your experience with the Democratic Party, your feelings about the Democratic Party, and why you're running as Democrats, given who the Democratic Party is today. You want to go, Jason?
Okay, I'll go first. Jason Call, Washington's 2nd District, which is northwest Washington going up to the Canadian border and from a little bit north of Seattle and the islands in the Puget Sound. And I've been an activist, as it says in my bio, for 30 years. I got my start in activism protesting the first Iraq war in 1990. I was a student at the University of Washington, and I've continued anti-war activism. But my involvement in it with the Democratic Party, when I first was in college and started to get into politics, and I was a political science major, that was my first degree. I got into local politics. I caucused for Bill Clinton. But as I kind of went through the Democratic Party, I did not vote for Bill Clinton in his second term. I voted for Ralph Nader. I did not vote for Al Gore. I voted for Ralph Nader. I know a lot of people hate to hear that because they want to say that Ralph Nader caused Al Gore to lose to George Bush, which is absolute rot. There are so many other reasons. But, you know, just to give you an idea of where my consciousness is now, George Bush was so terrible and I was inspired enough by Howard Dean and Dennis Kucinich in 2003 and 2004 that I decided to jump back into local politics. And I joined my local legislative district and, you know, I went and knocking doors for Howard Dean. And in 2008, I initially knocked doors for Dennis Kucinich and then he dropped out. I was, like Marianne said, I was enthused by Barack Obama. Again, you know, I worked hard for him. I literally cried when Barack Obama was elected. I was, you know, and I'm so anti-war that I actually left the country and went and lived in Cairo for a little while and taught math in Cairo. And, you know, I quit a very good job, sold everything I owned because I was so tired of the warmongering and I was so frustrated with my fellow Americans that they would reelect George and Dick Cheney. So I left the country, but came back, learned a lot being overseas. Very excited to vote for Barack Obama. And then within 2 years, he had pulled the public option out. And I've been a huge healthcare activist. My mom was impacted by the healthcare system. I tell my story in my ad that, you know, my mother was impacted by the insurance companies denying her, a stay in the hospital post-surgery that eventually led to her being, you know, bedridden, crippled, and really having a terrible quality of life for her last 10 years. And that's insurance companies. That's not doctors. It's not nurses. You know, it's not hospitals. It is the insurance companies denying that care. So when Barack Obama pulled the public option off the table, you know, negotiating towards the right wing, I just threw my hands up. I was incredibly frustrated. Now, I did vote for him again. But I really, really got into, like, I'm going to have to take the bull by the horns here with a lot of Bernie Sanders activists in 2016. And we, having been involved in the Democratic Party locally, we knew how the caucus system worked. And we literally trained people across the state how to caucus, what to expect when you show up. Here's how you need to vote. Here's how the voting's going to go. And we won the state for Bernie Sanders 73%. I mean, absolutely destroyed the establishment in the Washington State caucus. And they came back in 2 years and took the caucus away from us. So now we have a primary. Because if you look at all the caucus states around the country, Bernie won the caucus in I think every single one of them and won them substantially. So, you know, we are fighting this corporate establishment. And I say this, you know, Bernie Sanders won in 2016 here in Washington State. I had gotten myself elected to the Washington State Democrats Central Committee. I was part of rewriting the platform to be the most progressive platform we've ever had here in Washington State. I ran for party chair in 2018. And what I talked about was the Democratic Party needs to get off corporate money. I passed a resolution that we should not be taking for-profit health money. Everybody ignores it. In fact, I was told by party insiders, nobody cares about the platform. You know, we look at you people who are all jazzed up about this great platform and we laugh at you because none of these politicians care because they're all going to take the corporate money to get reelected. So, you know, that led to me, and that led to other people, activists, you know, left activists within the Democratic Party looking at me in 2020 and saying, hey, you got to take on this guy, you know, Rick Larson in Washington State, who's tied to fossil fuel industry money, tied to the military industrial complex, won't support Medicare for all, has said the Green New Deal is not an important resolution. We know where his interests are, and we have tracked his voting record, and it is absolutely atrocious. And most local Democrats don't even realize how bad it is because the details of the voting record aren't even in the final votes. They're in the amendment process. So as far as running as a Democrat, I have to say, while a lot of people on the left really want there to be a third party push, the reality of the electorate is that third parties simply don't get the votes. We had a Green Party member running in 2018, but they weren't a great candidate. They got like 0.5%. So if we're going to be serious about taking on the electorate here, we have to be Democrats, because that's what appeals to part of the electorate. I mean, some people simply won't vote for either, you know, outside of the Democratic Party, but we can have policies that speak to them. That's the thing, is they look at Medicare for All and say, yeah, we want that. Yeah, we want to stop these forever wars. And having a candidate who is like unbought and unbossed, like Shirley Chisholm said back in 1972, I mean, that's what we have to bring into the modern age. So, I mean, we can talk about the Squad and other candidates, but I think the new candidates that are running this year, the ones that are Marianne is supporting, like Rebecca and myself, we are with the Democratic Party because we know that's where the electorate is, but we are going to stand against the establishment of the Democratic Party. Like, I will say unequivocally right now, I would not have voted for Nancy Pelosi to be Speaker. You know, and if I was the only person who would not vote for her, then I'd stand alone as the only person who would not vote for her. We've got to do better.
So, Rebecca, I'm going to actually read a question on the screen, which speaks to what Jason just said. Democratic parties where good ideas go to die. Why not push the actual if there are any progressive elected members to start a new party within Congress? And you spoke to that a bit, Jason, but Rebecca, how would you respond to that?
Well, that was what the DSA candidates were supposed to do. DSA calls it the dirty break, and then none of them did it. So that's the problem with having an organization that doesn't hold its members accountable. And we need, if it's going to be a third party or an organization within the Democratic caucus in the House, where there are members who vote and actually hold them accountable and say, okay, you voted this way, you crossed XYZ line. So we are pulling our endorsement, we're pulling our money, we're going to blast everywhere that we don't support you anymore and we're primarying you. And people, oh, no, isn't it better to have somebody in there? No, it's not. They need to actually fight for what you believe in, or else what's the point? And the Progressive Caucus, I mean, has so much overlap with the New Democrat Coalition. And unfortunately, Washington State is very overrepresented in that the New Democrat Coalition, because we have the Seattle-Tacoma port and a lot of international trade. So we have a lot of free market Democrats, free market and balance the... My opponent is such a deficit hawk that he brags on his site that he returned money from his office that was unused to pay off the deficit. Like, who'd you give it to? Come on. So anyway, should I introduce myself before I continue ranting? Or
yeah, I mean, I did introduce you, but if you wanted to give it for people who are just joining, yes. Certainly.
Sure. Yeah, Rebecca Farson. And my background is I grew up overseas until I was 12. And my mother is German. So I've had a lot of views into how other countries do things and what we could have here. And in Tacoma, I'm a Tacoma Disabilities Commissioner. And I ran in 2020, got 35,000 votes. And then after that, I co-founded a group called Tacoma Housing Now. And we did direct action. We took over a middle school that had been empty for 12 years, used it for emergency pandemic housing. We got a lot of media attention. We started doing stuff like the city refused to pick up trash for homeless encampments. So we got some U-Hauls. We got this idea from the Young Lords in the 70s. We went and rented some U-Hauls and went down to the camps, shoveled the mountains of trash into them, and then took the entirely full U-Hauls and dumped the trash in front of City Hall. And what do you know? They suddenly picked up the trash. And so that's what people say when, oh, government can't, we can't, it has to go, we're not service providers. We can't, I'm a city council member. I'm not a service provider. Our hands are tied. What can I do? It's like, well, lo and behold, direct action. Suddenly new things are possible. Suddenly you can pick up trash in 12 hours. And so that's the kind of thing that I'm interested in doing in Congress, because people say, why are you running as a Democrat? The Democratic Party is where is the graveyard of movements. I've heard that, and it's been a saying for a long time. But like Jason said, I mean, in my district as well, I've had past congressional elections before I ran where there was a Green, there was an Independent. They never got more than 4.8% of the vote. And people say that they hate both of the parties, that they want a third party, but a lot of Democrats, they vote in terms of what they think is electable. Every Democrat is an individual pundit filling in the bubble when they're voting. And so they think, what is going to be most electable so that we don't get the Republican? And a lot of people, we have a top two jungle primary system here where everybody just runs against everybody else. And even voters here don't know that we have that. They think it's a closed primary. And so they'll explain, no, there's no, absolutely no risk. Best case scenario, you have two Democrats running against each other. So the electorate is in a very different place, even though people are very disillusioned and unhappy. But the positive, one thing that's been really positive for my last campaign, our biggest group of ID supporters by far was seniors receiving under $20,000 a year in income. So very impoverished seniors were my biggest group by far. So when you think, oh, how can we get more votes? How can we pull more people in? Young people don't vote, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, we need to pull in young people and renters. I'm going to do that. But poor old people want all of these policies. They want Social Security to be expanded. They don't want my opponent. My opponent joined with Republicans to sign a letter calling for Social Security cuts. And we blasted that out there and showed people. Like, people are not, you can't just put people over 65, they're going to vote a certain way. People 50 to 65, they're going to vote this way. It depends on their circumstances and actually being reached out to and you offering a different solution.
Yeah, we have a 2-to-1 district here, and I think it's about the same in Rebecca's. And there's a lot of similarity between the race that I'm running, the race that Rebecca's running. You know, I got 35,000. This is my second run. I got about 35,000 votes in 2020 also. And, you know, Rick Larson has also, you know, it's been a little while, but he's a deficit hawk, right? So he said all things should be on the table when we're considering balancing budgets, you know? So what does that mean? That's a tacit approval of cutting Social Security. So when people start to realize these things, because, you know, a lot of the local party stuff is controlled by, you know, people who look at the Democratic Party as more of a social club rather than a vehicle to get policy passed. And so they like to show up to the meetings. And, you know, these are people that are typically retired, but they like to rub elbows with the elected officials and they don't like to criticize the elected officials. Like, honestly, I Susan DelBene, she's the chair of the New Democrats right now, and she's in the first district in Washington, but her district overlaps my local legislative district, so I get to engage with her sometimes also. And, you know, she came to a local meeting and she was so excited because over half the Democrats are now supporting impeaching Trump. And I said, well, over half the Democrats are supporting Medicare for All. Why aren't you one of them? I got called a bully for saying that. You know, this is a public Democratic Party meeting, and I just rattled off facts and figures about how Medicare for All was the best policy for everybody and save the country money, and we wouldn't be denying, you know, but obviously we got to cut out the for-profit insurance industry. And these local Democratic Party people who have been there, you know, for a long time, and I've been there in the background for a long time too, but they hate that. Oh, it's so bad. Why would you criticize a sitting Democrat? And a lot of us who are running right now are challenging establishment Democrats, and we get that criticism from within the party. Why would you attack the Democratic Party? And my response is, these people actually don't represent the Democratic Party that I think it should be. Right. So I'm there for the policy. You know, I'm not there to support the Democratic Party. I'm there for whatever I can do to support the right policies. You know, it's obviously not the Republicans, but the Democratic Party is not getting it done either. So that's what we are offering to people. You know, we're people who will step up and speak to the policy, speak to the people who are impacted by the corporate establishment right now. And hopefully that's going to get us the votes, Joe, Rebecca and I, to get us onto the general election ballot. And so for the last 3 months, because our primary is first week in August, we're going to have 3 months down the stretch where hopefully attention will be on us, D on D, in the primary. And we're just going to lay it all out there. And yeah, absolutely, I am going to go after the corporate establishment of the Democratic Party. And if the voters still want that, then they're going to vote for it. But if they want better, then they're going to vote for Rebecca and I.
Yeah, and another comment that I wanted to put out there, just to challenge you guys, from Brian: too many Justice Democrats will not challenge the Democratic leadership. They praise Biden and Pelosi. Why will Jason and Rebecca be any different? So there is a question of a structural problem, right? Institutional design by which it's impossible once you get into power to do anything. So how would you respond to that?
Do you want to take that one, Rebecca?
Yeah, and I called on Joe Biden to drop out after the very credible sexual assault allegations came out against him. I took a lot of heat for that, and local Democrats started making up trash about me and lies and spreading it. And he should have dropped out, and any other Democrat would have been better. Any Democrat who's not, doesn't have serious sexual assault allegations against them. And I'm quoted in Politico saying that. I have a video coming out where I'm going to talk about Pelosi. The way Pelosi first got into office was she became a very wealthy fundraiser. So lots of money, lots of connections because of that, people who owed her favors, and she was able to pull in a lot of money. And she beat a DSA candidate to get her seat, while promising single-payer healthcare. So that's what she's been from the very beginning. Single-payer healthcare, beats a DSA candidate, gets in, and now she opposes it. And I'm going to continue to call them out. I do now. And so, for example, with trying to get concessions from her in exchange for voting for her, like for me, the choice would be, no, I'm not going to vote for her. I disagree with her on so many things. So she takes practically legalized insider trading. She takes so much corporate money. She crushes any progress. You would have to really, really give me something good to make me want to vote for that. Instead of just kind of giving it all up and like, well, we have to vote for her, that kind of thing.
You know, Katie, you had mentioned that it was a structural problem, but it's not. It's like what Rebecca just said. It's a psychological problem. The Democratic voters, so many of them have this codependent relationship with the corporatist leadership. You don't see this in the Republican Party. If the Republican Party, I mean, look at people like Eric Cantor. They didn't like him. They got rid of him. They have no problem telling their Republican leadership. To them, their RNC is just their administrative arm. It doesn't mean anything. Democrats treat the DNC like there's some priesthood or something like that. And I think it's important what Rebecca just said. And it's never time. And you see it right now. People would be looking at us right now. How dare we, when we know that the 2022 elections are coming up, how can you do this right now? It's never a good time. Every cycle, we better keep our mouths shut, because what are you going to get Republicans elected? What we're saying is what Jason was just saying. The one thing he is in control of is whether or not the voters in his district have the option of someone like him. And so we don't even know. And, you know, the Democratic Party, the corporatist establishment has been saying for so long, no, if you go so far to the left, we'll help elect Republicans. What should even be considered leftist about the fact that people should be able to work for more than slave wages? People should be able to work at one job and afford an apartment. People should be able to get a college degree. Children shouldn't live out of their cars. Why should this even be considered a leftist issue? It's a radically humanitarian issue. It's a democratic issue. It's a government of the people, by the people, and for the people issue. And if the democratic establishment doesn't get it, I agree with what Rebecca and Jason have been saying. And everybody who has complaints about the squad, I don't know these people. I would imagine some of them regret the fact that they went along at the very beginning. It must have been very seductive. I'm sure Nancy gave people her cell phone and they got played. I assume they know this. And I can't imagine that some of them don't regret the way they played at a time.
And I would also like to add into that, you know, I've been very public. Like if I'm elected to Congress, I'm not going to join the Progressive Caucus. I think the Progressive Caucus, I've called the Progressive Caucus trash as it stands right now. They have a ton of new Democrats. Rebecca mentioned that, you know, we've got 7 Democrats out of our 10 districts here in Washington State. Pramila Jayapal is the only one who is not a new Democrat. A lot of Democrats don't realize that the new Democrats, if you kind of track them back to the third way Democrats that came out of the Clinton era, they were and are specifically a free trade caucus. They were given seated by Koch brother money. And Rick Larson has taken Koch brother money in the past before Citizens United went into effect and the Koch brothers, you know, could do everything, you know, behind the scenes. Rick Larson took Koch brother money. I don't think a lot of Democrats recognize this, but to I could not sit in the table. You guys probably know who Adam Smith is. He's the chair of the House Armed Services Committee. You know, I couldn't sit at the same table with Adam Smith or any of the new Democrats you know, these Democrats that take a ton of money from the war machine and the fossil fuel industry, that's not progressive to me. So if words have any meaning at all, I would not join the Progressive caucus until they actually set some standards. In fact, I would hope that a number of us running right now, if we get elected, would form our own caucus outside of the Progressive Caucus and then look at people like Rashida Tlaib, who I love. I love Rashida. I love Cori Bush, you know, and I would look at them and I would say, come join us, right? Let's us be this voting bloc. You can let the Progressive Caucus sort out their issues, right? If they want to have standards, you know, they'll figure that out. But I'm not going to join that because I have standards.
You know, if it's okay for us to switch a little bit to the event on February 16th, which Jason will be part of and Rebecca will be part of, Katie, I think that's what's so exciting for me and why at candidatesummit.com, I've been doing these endorsements for a while. Jason and I have known each other. It's wonderful to finally get to meet you, Rebecca. What I see with these endorsed candidates and what you see here with Rebecca and with Jason, this is what America could be. This is what could be. You know, it's like we're living at a time of two simultaneous phenomena. One's the fall of Rome, and one's this world that's struggling to be born. And I just think it's so important that when we listen to people like Rebecca and Jason, that we support them. That you, if the answers, you know, to the people who are saying, yeah, why should we, you know, support a Democrat at this time? Why, how, you know, aren't I just going to be disappointed like I was by certain members of the squad or whatever? I just hope that those who are listening to Rebecca and Jason know that obviously it's very difficult to wage these campaigns against these corporate-backed candidates. The establishment power is gargantuan. The money that the corporatists put in is gargantuan. But when you see people like Rebecca and you see people like Jason, they'll help us. If we get them to Congress, they'll help us, but we need to help them to get them to a position where they could help us. So I hope that people will support. And Katie, of course, that's why we're doing the live stream on February 16th.
Yeah, and we'll have a link to that soon.
And you can also, people can go now, though, to candidatesummit.com and see a bunch of these candidates, including Rebecca and Jason. So you can start spreading the word and giving to candidates right now and telling people, you know, I find it so inspiring to meet people like this because we do have candidates who are running, representing these sensibilities, representing these policies, representing these possibilities for the United States. But we have to support these candidates and we have to psychologically tune into the fact these primaries are coming up. Jason was just saying August, you know, we've got to help these people. It's time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, so much is possible. And I think that's been lost. At the beginning of the pandemic, people were saying, wow, it's terrible what's happening, but look at what could be done. We could get Medicare for all by lowering the Medicare eligibility age to zero. But there's so much that's possible that's not even talked about. And from our own history, like when I talk about national rent control, people are like, no, you can't do that. We already did it. We have already had national rent control and we could have it again. Biden could do it with an executive order. He could create an agency that would then implement price controls, including rent control. We could do it nationally. And so this kind of very, very small thinking and fighting online, like we've forgotten sight of what's possible and what we could be doing and could be fighting for and asking for.
You know, if we look at the COVID rates in the United States compared to the COVID rates in other countries, you see the difference between the United States and countries where there's socialized medicine. Why? Because in the United States, so many people had the pre-existing conditions that made them more vulnerable to COVID. Why? Because of the absence of healthcare. People who did not have the healthcare to handle such things as diabetes. Diabetes is one of the worst things for someone who has COVID. But look how many Americans cannot afford their insulin. How many Americans are dealing with health conditions when they get COVID that were those conditions not present, they would not have been so vulnerable. That's what Medicare for All would do. We'd be a healthier country.
One of the things I wanted to talk about, Marianne, you brought it up with the candidate summit and the fundraiser that we've got upcoming. A federal race is a huge undertaking. You know, I think a lot of people who, you know, are very active online and very passionate online sometimes don't understand what kind of undertaking it is to try and present yourself to, you know, 750,000 people in your federal district and try and get them to take you seriously enough to show up. So the fact that, you know, Rebecca and I ran our races last year and got 35,000 votes. That's a good start. That's not enough, you know, and we did that on, you know, my budget last year was like $50,000, you know, so I am really impressed with myself and my team, but it was an all volunteer. It was an all volunteer team that did that. And, you know, we're passionate about the policy and we have a pretty good idea of the things that we need to do, but, you know, we have to have the money to have paid staff. You know, we talk a lot about wages. I don't want people working for me for free. If people are going to put labor into my campaign, I think that they should get paid for it. You know, that's going to take people donating. And when you take the D, and this I'm strictly, you know, strictly talking about the importance of having the D behind your name. If we took the D away from our name, our fundraising would go off a cliff. It absolutely would.
We would be immediately kicked off Act Blue, and then all the donors wouldn't. How do I donate? What platform?
Yep.
It's so true. It's so true. And all this anti-electoralism talk that people have gotten into and all this cynicism now. Meanwhile, there are people like yourselves who are out there actually doing it, taking these hits. It's a brutal thing running for office. And I have such admiration for you that you're out there. And I hope that everybody who listens, just go to candidatesummit.com and put in a few dollars for these people.
And we're also doing it with, you know, Rebecca and I both have full-time jobs. So we're kind of doing double duty, trying to hold down a job where the incumbents running for office is part of their, like, you know, Rick Larson's going around the district talking to all the people about how wonderful the infrastructure bill is. Well, he's campaigning as he's doing that. Campaigning for the incumbents is actually part of their job. They're almost inextricable. So it's not like he has a job and then has a campaign on the side. They're one and the same, where the candidates who are challenging these incumbents are really doing double duty.
Rebecca, can I throw a chat to you that is very critical of you, but I kind of want, only because I really want to see you respond to it, because I think you'll be able to handle it.
Okay.
I just think maybe it's a teachable moment. Calling out Biden, me too, not voting for Nancy. What about the foreign policy? What about poverty? What about the police state, non-boutique issues? Do you care about any of those, Rebecca? Do you ever speak out against any of those?
Yes, I actually, one of the things I'm most interested in is foreign policy. I talk about it on Twitter the most. For example, what's going on with Ukraine and Russia right now. So Russia's about to invade. And Ukraine's like, no, it's not. Really, we're fine. And then we say, no, here's $500 million to defend yourself against the imminent invasion that you say is not imminent. It's ridiculous. Just handing out money to defense contractors as if we haven't done enough meddling in Ukraine already. And then, you know, we think Russia is planning to install a leader in Ukraine. And it's like, wow, that would be kind of funny because we were planning to do the exact same thing in 2014, I think it was. And a call leaked where we were planning, let's put this guy in and not that guy.
Right.
And meanwhile, like, Ukraine doesn't even want our intervention. And there's so much we're doing in terms of foreign policy. Like, I grew up, my grandfather was a career Army, retired as a colonel. I grew up overseas because my dad was in the Foreign Service, and I'm very critical of our institutions. I chose not to go into the Foreign Service because I didn't want to be sitting in an embassy working on promoting policies and immigration policies and foreign policy that I don't agree with. That's why I didn't do it. But I did learn a lot, and I have since as well. For example, we sell so much money, weapons to Saudi Arabia to form what is essentially a modern day siege on Yemen, starving people. You know, Afghanistan had billions and billions of dollars of their own money sitting in a bank account in New York, and we just froze it. And so now children are literally starving in Afghanistan, and it's just going to get worse. And it's their money. It's theirs. We just said, no, you can't have it. So we've essentially just taken it. Nope, that's ours now. And so I do care a lot about foreign policy and also how it connects with domestic policy, because sometimes people say, well, you have a military base in your district. What about that? Well, some people join the military because they're from a military family, or they do it out of patriotism, but many people do it out of poverty. It's a poverty draft. And they do it because it's the only way the only way they can get college and housing and a decent, you know, not high enough income is to put their life on the line. Like, I literally have to put my body out there as, like, throw it on the gears of the war machine, so that I can just get an education. And so if we spent less time and money focused on that, not only would we ease the suffering of people that we're trampling on overseas, but we would be able to spend more time and money on programs for people here. And yeah, so I care a lot about foreign policy. I think poverty as well. Marianne mentioned, you know, oh, all this trumpeting about cutting child poverty in half. But they cut it in, and rightly noting, like, it was only temporary. And if you can cut it in half, you can cut all of it. You know, if you can afford tax breaks for billionaires, you can get children out of poverty. Children should not be literally sleeping in the woods, which they are in my district, sleeping in the woods. And people should not be dying waiting in line for drug treatment, which they are in my district, and which I've personally dealt with, taking a friend who had lethal blood alcohol content, nowhere would take her, took her to the ER. They reluctantly saw her. And then the next day they dumped her back out on the street. That was her detox because there was nowhere that would take her Medicaid. So yeah, I take the point that these are boutique issues, and it's not necessarily what I would be talking about with voters at the door. You know, they care about, they want to hear about jobs for all. Like, believe it or not, a lot of Republicans in my district still really like FDR. And there's a big lodge in my district on this lake that it kind of looks like the lodge in Dirty Dancing. And they have, like, the dining hall in it is called the Roosevelt Room. They love it. They jobs. And they remember when he came to the district, he was the only one. And since then, no other presidential candidates or sitting presidents have come to their community, and people want jobs. And so when I'm at the door, I'm not really talking about this inside baseball stuff, but it is important, I think, for us to talk about because it's strategy. And we need to be serious about power, how it works, how it's used, how we attain it. And then once we have it, how we use it. It's really, you know, I think both sides are important to talk about.
Yeah. And I would just, part of the reason I wanted to pass that question to you is because I think that some people could lean into some humility and maybe look into what people are saying and not assume that they're idiots and naive. And Rebecca and Jason have done great work, and Rebecca's done tons of work around housing. She's been unhoused herself. So you don't need to lecture her about how she only cares about boutique issues. I also have a problem with framing Me Too as a boutique issue, but that's another issue. Thank you, Rebecca, for that, because I just wanted to give you the chance because, you know, people who run for office as Democrats may not actually think that all the power that we need to exert is within electoralism. There are a lot of people who use electoralism but are fully aware of how important movements are and direct action is, and that's great. And we can have a chat about that. But these aren't the people who are saying it's either or.
They can all be together.
Yeah.
Well, the problem we have today, though, is that movements have less power than they used to. BLM was the largest protest movement in the history of the United States, and it has not led to one serious fundamental legislative change. So in the past, you know, if you look at the civil rights movement, that led to the Voting Rights Act. It led to the Civil Rights Act. Because of money and politics at this point, all the activism in the world, and it's not moving these people off their dime as long as they are at the behest of these corporate forces. And at this point, it's not even, see, this is to me, it's an argument for electoralism. We have to be proactively for electoralism. It's not enough to try to influence these people now, because there are too many ways in which they will not be influenced. They have to be replaced. That's where we are. There's no, you know, have this movement, then we'll influence them. No, at this point, these people need to be, too many of them have been there too long. They need to go home, and a whole new generation of leadership has to take their place in Congress and in the White House.
And when we're talking about the timeline that needs to happen, it needs to happen very quickly. I mean, I think we're all just acutely aware. I have this picture. This is Mount Stewart in the Wenatchee Mountains behind me. And I took this picture. I go to Eastern Washington sometimes for work, and I took this picture at the height of the heat wave in the summer. And that mountain, even, you know, in the middle of summer, that mountain should be snow capped, you know, and I was just stunned at how little snow there was on Mount Stewart, the seventh highest peak in Washington State. And I think that, you know, if we want to set a timeline for things happening, we've really got to do it right now and try and get some solidarity behind, you know, and it doesn't have to all happen with an electoralism. All the movements are important, and I'm involved in multiple movements and have been for the last 30 years, you know, but we still have to get legislative changes happening or we are not going to get fossil fuel reductions, emissions reductions, and you know, we're just going to spiral out of control with the planet. And that is right now my biggest concern. If you want to put anything that was at the very top of my list, we have got to get a handle on what's happening with the climate emergency.
Well, this has been great, guys. Really want to thank you. We'll do this again next week. Also, we will be moving right now to call-in. And so I want to invite everyone, including our guests, they're going to join us there. And remember how to do that. You just check your phones. You just download the call-in app. It's free. And we will see you very soon, literally like in a minute or two on call-in. And thank you so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Okay, see you guys next week. Love you all. Thanks for coming. Thanks for joining the show. Bye, everyone. Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper, Nick Palm. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Turn your tax refund into a new kitchen with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Renovate your space with new cabinets from Cardell. They're ready to install and come in a variety of styles and finishes with free shipping to your home. Visit our kitchen showrooms in-store or go to Menards.com for free estimates today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all of our hot deals going on now. Save big.